It's just that natural instinct to make beautiful things and to be surrounded by them. It'd be a very, very sad world if we took that kind of artistic element away and had purely practical things around us.
Pottery is very important to us. One, as a major step in the evolution of human culture, and secondly, as a dating mechanism.
Pottery is a practical and beautiful thing. It has been made in Ireland for over 4,000 years and is the hallmark of settlement in our landscape. From just tiny shards of clay, archaeologists can uncover the stories of long-forgotten cultures and societies.
Pottery's around the back here if you want to come around.
I'm at a workshop in St. Johnston, where potter Brian McGee continues this ancient tradition.
Dewish Hill, the Black Saddle. We're just outside of St. Johnston, about 3 miles to the east. We found this place about 25 years ago now, when we were just house hunting when we first got married. I like it because it's near to Derry. It's within 10 miles, and also about 10 miles from Letterkenny, but it's a little haven and so on, you know. Gets a bit wild in the winter up here, but it's still lovely.
It's so quiet. It's a beautiful location, and we're looking south here.
Looking south towards the direction of Raphoe, and you can see the Donegal Mountains in the distance, and even as far as Omagh now.
So this is where all the magic happens, Brian.
Yeah.
Well, great workshop.
Well, it's an interesting workshop. It was actually built, it's actually started life, believe it or not, as an old Irish army hut. And I bought it and brought it up from Kilkenny, and then we kind of rebuilt it with a new roof and everything. So I suppose most people, when they think about pottery, they think about the potter's wheel. And it's not necessarily the case. A lot of people make pottery without ever using the wheel, you know. When I trained at art college, I kind of gravitated towards making pots on the potter's wheel. I found I could do it relatively well. But then, of course, when I left college and got a job with a fellow called Lowry Wasson that runs Moville Pottery, he revealed to me that I really knew nothing at all and I had to start from scratch with him. So it took 2 years training with him, and then I worked for him for a few years, and then started my own. Right. So, let me get the clay. Can I just show you? The clay comes in bags. It's been filtered and purified a little bit. And when it comes to us in these bags, there's no little stones or grit or anything like that.
And it has that same sticky consistency like a daub.
Yeah. Now, what I do is I knead the clay. That's K-N-E-A-D, knead, like a baker would, just to make sure it's all well mixed up.
And you're getting a degree of pliability into it as well.
Yeah, to a certain extent. But it's just to mix the clay and make sure that it's a nice, even consistency. So
it's a beautiful grey colour.
Yeah.
At this point, it's just...
This is a stoneware clay. It's actually imported. Most of the clay we have in Ireland is, you know, the red terracotta clay that you make, you know, chimney pots and flower pots out of. But it's a clay that's a more high-firing clay. So it's now ready to put on the wheel and make into the shape. You know, mostly when you're making pots on the wheel, it's your hands that are a basic way of making them, you know. And I'll show you how we do that now.
I suppose, like, when you think about the history of things that are handmade and pottery in particular, while it may have been necessity, the crafts people put a lot of beauty into it. Mm. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, right from the earliest days, if you look at how, you know, Stone Age people, they painted on the walls of their cave, you know, but it often was something to do with magic. So while you're right about they wanted to make practical things, and clay pottery was very useful for that, they also made little objects, little animals and little people and that kind of thing, often with magical properties, you know. So it's one of the early examples of people making art, but also making craft, you know, something that was useful.
It seems to be that there's an instinct to make your mark in something that's handmade as well. Is that something that you think is true?
People are we are sustained by beauty, and I don't think that you can make something just purely for practical, well, you can make something purely for practical reasons, but it isn't very long before people start adding their own little touches. And that's one of the great things I always think, is that everybody has their own creativity in them. It's a human instinct, and the things we make, the things that we produce, often, nearly always, will reflect that, you know. It's an electric wheel. So, just taking the clay, and the first thing I do is smack it right down on the centre of the wheel, and just push it in the middle. And start the wheel at full speed. So one of the first things that they do is cone it, and then we're pushing it back down on centre, and then we just make a little dimple in the middle of the clay.
So you're pushing your finger down into the centre.
Pushing my finger down into the centre now, and pulling it back and making a little, just the basics of a little kind of bowl shape. And then I start to thin out the walls and make them taller.
And as you're doing that, it looks like it's deceptively getting larger and larger as it pulls up, but there's these most beautiful rings forming all the way on the outside.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things about when you make pots on by hand, you're left with what's called the throwing rings, which are the finger marks on the side. And it's kind of, it's nice because you don't get that on industrial pottery, you know, so it kind of, it shows that it's been handmade.
Why is the handmade element of something like this so important?
I think it's almost because of it. Because everything is so mass-produced and manufactured, and machinery and robots and everything are involved, and often you're using some things that aren't that have never been touched by a human being in the whole manufacture. It's because of that that people like to have the handmade thing as well. You know, because of what I was saying earlier, it's just that natural instinct to make beautiful things and to be surrounded by them. It'd be a very, very sad world if we took that kind of artistic element away and had purely practical things around us.
When you see the things that people put a value on, do ordinary things like a plate or a bowl, do they tell us a bit about who we are, you know, in terms of what we value?
Not everybody can afford expensive things, and I make expensive pieces. I also make very cheap pieces. I always try to, you know, like for instance, you can buy a mug for, you know, 15 euros. It's not going to break the bank. Might be a little bit more expensive than you buy it in a supermarket, but it's handmade. It's been made by someone who's put all their heart and love and you know, ability into it. So I don't think that's asking too much. And I think people do appreciate it now more. And as far as whether it's important for people to be surrounded with these things, it's up to people themselves to make those choices. I'm not going to dictate to people whether they should have these things. I just make them. And if they like them, that's great.
And pottery is made to last. It's an unusual craft in that it can survive for hundreds or even thousands of years, as has been the case here in Donegal.
Many examples of those are found. I was involved in the excavation of two of them myself in the south of Donegal, down near Killybegs.
Archaeologist Brian Lacey is a former lecturer and director of the annual Glencolumbkill Archaeology Summer School.
They dated to about, say, 1800 BC or thereabouts.
What's the kind of oldest pottery that we found here in the county?
Yeah, well, you know, the invention of pottery and the making of pottery is always understood as one of the great advances in human civilization, allowing all sorts of, you know, things to happen, storage and cooking in different ways and all that sort of thing. So we, you know, the arrival of pottery is really thought of as a remarkable thing. And here in Ireland, humans have been living on the island of Ireland as far back as about 10,500 BC or thereabouts, very primitive in their way of life. And they just lived off hunting and fishing and collecting natural foods. But then about 4,000 BC, a huge change takes place and we get the first farmers coming to Ireland. And they brought all these new things with them. And one of the most important things they brought with them was the knowledge of pottery making and using pottery vessels. And quite a lot of that survives, turns up particularly now in excavations, when the tombs, the ancient tombs, are being excavated. Because pottery, by and large, doesn't deteriorate, it survives in the ground. And of course, it changes. People are always changing their styles and that. Pottery is also very important in archaeology because it can be used for dating purposes. You know, if you find a particular piece of pot from, you know, depending on the date, you can, you know, establish the date of the site around it and things like that. So pottery is very important to us on those two grounds. One, as a major step in the evolution of human culture, and secondly, as a dating mechanism.
Since its arrival in Ireland some 6,000 years ago, pottery styles have evolved. And these styles offer archaeologists clues to life in ancient Ireland, like when influences came in from abroad. But pottery can also throw up mysteries.
So different peoples had different styles of making their pottery, and we can identify those styles because they turn up a relatively large number. And then about 2,500 BC, things change again, and there is the beginnings of the Bronze Age. And there's a type of pottery that's known as beaker. It's kind of an obvious kind of a name, but beaker pottery is found all over Western Europe. And that continues into and towards the end of the Bronze Age, the transition from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. So then, strangely enough, pottery disappears from the Irish record. And that's very unusual in a European context. So, you know, by this stage, the big civilizations of the Mediterranean have been established in Egypt and Greece and then the Roman Empire. And of course, they made wonderful pots, fabulous pots, which people go and look at in museums now. But it all just disappears from Ireland. And that's really unusual. You know, back to what I was saying earlier on, that if pottery is almost a symbol of kind of advance in human civilization, did we go backwards in some way? Well, probably not. We don't know why pottery disappears in Ireland during the Iron Age, but it does. And almost certainly it was replaced by wooden vessels. And I mean, those that have survived, there are beautiful bowls and particularly drinking vessels going right on into the Middle Ages that we call nethers. Beautiful carved wooden objects with handles and all sorts of things. Now, in the meantime, some pieces of pottery are being imported, particularly from the Roman Empire. We know that during the Roman Empire, huge pottery vessels, which might have contained wine or olive oil or whatever, those kinds of things, were being traded into Ireland. But while that is coming, you know, these imported pieces are coming into Ireland, there's nothing in our own native culture. There's no pottery maker, very little. There is some, but it's very crude. It's a bit like hard brown bread, you know, it's really crude stuff. And it is found, we give names, souterrainware, various chronoware, various names are used to describe this. But it's really crude stuff when compared to what, you know, what's being made in the Mediterranean at the same time. So for whatever reason, pottery disappears out of the what we call the native Irish record around the time of a couple of centuries before the time of Christ anyway. And then it really doesn't reappear until modern times to some extent.
So I'm just squeezing it together a little bit now, and then I start to thin out the walls and make them taller by just squeezing the clay.
And as you're doing that, the clay is moving. It looks like it's deceptively getting larger and larger as it pulls up, but there's these most beautiful rings forming all the way on the outside.
Well, that's one of the things about when you make pots on by hand, you're left with what's called the throwing rings, which are the finger marks on the side, and it's nice because you don't get that on industrial pottery, you know, so it shows that it's been handmade. You can make it extremely kind of uniform, but then you're losing your throwing rings.
I see that, yeah. You straightened it out and it's getting flatter at the sides now as it went through.
Yeah.
You have a piece of wire with two little pieces of wood at the end and you slid that under it. That's
slice that through underneath, and then, in theory, it should be liftable. it's so fluid and so bendable, you know, I could knock out a shape so easy, but just to see it sitting there.
And when you lifted it, I mean, there's obviously, because it is so wet still, the, you know, imprint of your hand lifting it is on the pot. Mm-hmm. How do you...
I would just sponge around the pot afterwards with a sponge and
right,
take any unwanted finger marks off. But sometimes I like to leave them on. I mean, I love sometimes when I go to museums and things, I can see pottery that was made thousands of years ago with a thumb mark on it.
Yes.
And it's such an intimate personal thing. It's almost like a connection between you and that ancient potter all those thousands of years ago. And it kind of can get quite emotional, you know, because it's such an intimate thing. So sometimes I just like to leave my finger mark there for posterity, and who knows, maybe in several thousand years' time, some archaeologist might be digging my pots up and studying my fingerprint on the site.
So you have some of the finished product here in front of us, Brian.
Small collection, yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I make a tableware range with a simple white glaze on them, and then I decorate on top of the white glaze using ceramic colours. I make a range which I call the chough range, you know, the chough bird. And it's just because I love the wildlife in Donegal, and this is kind of to celebrate that. I also make more sculptural pieces. And again, talking about the wildlife, there's these sharks I make, basking sharks. I'm fascinated by the basking sharks that you get off the coast, you know. And
that's beautiful. I mean, that's kind of, they're hand-painted then after they're glazed.
Yeah, hand-decorated. But we do use the little sponge for the decoration. It's called spongeware. It's a very old Irish tradition. They actually used to produce a lot of this kind of stuff way back in the 19th century. And at one stage, for a film about the famine called The Hanging Gale, that was made here a few years back,
yeah,
I actually designed all the pottery for them. So, you know, and replicated the original kind of pottery that they would have made at the time, you know.
And your colours are very natural, is how I would describe them. Like, they seem, you know, quite organic. You know, there's yeah, nothing primary. Where do you get your inspiration for that?
Well, the colours are natural because the ingredients are natural. I mean, there's wood ash, it's ground stone of various types, you know, basically granite ground down. And then the colours are got from natural oxides. Occasionally, I would use manufactured colours, which I bring in and... from the suppliers, but they always look different. It's a little bit like the difference between natural dyes in clothing and artificial dyes. They're always that bit brighter, and which is lovely if you want to do nice brightly colored stuff, but the color palette is a bit more subtle and a bit more natural looking if you only use natural materials. Like copper oxide will give you green, iron oxide gives you reddy brown, cobalt will give you blue, and if you use those basic chemicals, basic minerals, then that's the kind of natural palette that you end up working with.
So there's a bit of alchemy involved as well, is there?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, but I haven't managed to make gold yet, but might get to there eventually.
Making a living is central to supporting any creative life. And if pottery is a solitary occupation, with other Donegal craft workers, Brian has found a community that share the running of a shop to provide a valuable outlet for all their work.
The Donegal Designer Makers is a group of about 20 different craftspeople in Donegal. We all make different crafts. There's, you know, all sorts of things, jewellers, furniture makers, people making clothing of various sorts, designers, ceramicists or potters, or there's one woman even does origami. But we formed about 5 or 6 years ago, and we set up a shop in Ardara where we sell our work in a little gallery. We share the rent, we share the running of the shop, staffing it and everything. And it's kind of a model that we'd seen working in Wales, in a place called Crafts in the Bay. We followed it here. And since then, a lot of people have taken interest, and they've set up similar places in Derry, down Carrick and Shannon and various other parts of the country, you know. So it's a good model for craftspeople to get together, get rid of that sense of isolation, because we're all just working in little individual workshops all over the country. And it's been very successful, and the shop's shop is, you know, increasing in sales every year, and we're starting to get more interest from people all the time, you know. We have about 14 people, I think, in the shop now. We can either choose to pay a higher rent, we can't take the time to help staff the shop, or else we pay a lower rent, and we take about 10 days every year. And we also employ a woman to work in there part-time as well.
Great, yeah.
And run the place. So it's just in the main street, just opposite Nancy's Bar. Lovely spot, you should call in.
When you do something like this that's accessible, that you can make yourself or whatever, mm-hmm. it democratizes almost our access to beauty and beautiful things. Should beauty be a universal right?
Yeah, that's a very interesting idea, and I like it. I think that, you know, we are often told what to buy or told what's lovely or told what's good, you know, through social media or whatever. But I love the fact that I can drive into St. Johnson from my home here. I pass a little house and there's a woman who has got all these little ducks and dog sculptures, and she's painted the house really bright colours, and she has little iron pots sitting outside, and she, this is just totally natural to her. She's totally unself-conscious about her, and her house is just beautiful. And to me, that gives me, it makes me smile every time I pass it. And I think it's an encouragement to everyone else. She doesn't care about ridicule or anything else. She's just perfectly natural, and she's an artist. We all are. I think it should be one of the rights, didn't you say, that we all should be able to enjoy.
So, my turn.
Your turn. Do you want to have a try? You might want to put on.
Yeah.
Okay, now I will try to help you, but really, you're largely on your own here.
Okay.
The pedal for to increase the speed is on your left-hand side. Now, just get a feel for the pedal. Just feel on the left there. Can you get it right down to full speed? Stop the wheel just to throw the clay on. Give it a good smack down.
Not in the center.
Well, just pull it towards the center a little bit by hand.
Okay.
And now if you start the wheel up, get the wheel. Now just put your hands under the water bowl and get your hands wet. A little bit faster. That's about the speed there. Now, if you put your hands around the clay and with your left hand push towards the center, and with your right hand pull back towards the center, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And push down as well. That's not too bad. If you can really lock your elbow into your
The pressure that I'm applying to this is pretty significant.
You've got
now.
It on center, well done. But let the pressure off gently now that you have it there.
Off the speed.
Yeah, just take your hands off gently. Now, the speed can maintain, but remove your hands from the clay slowly. And that's good, yeah.
Okay. And you do everything here.
Yeah.
So it goes from this stage right through to the finishing.
Yeah, it's a one-person workshop at the moment, and I'm heading towards retirement. And well, I don't think potters ever really retire. We just kind of fade away.
Reduce the volume.
It
is that balance between the creativity and the industry, and where you start to lose the enjoyment when it's just business.
And I have to say, it's lovely to get up in the morning and be looking forward to what you're making, and generally speaking I do, because I'm totally in control of what I make. I decide, and as long as we have a shop in Ardara, a gallery down there that's where most of my work sells, and you know, I'm fairly free just to make whatever I want, and whatever, obviously the public's to want it as well. But it's not, it's a very creative process, and I'm totally in control of it at all times, you know, which is nice.
And now we're starting to lose the shape.
Just turn your hand at the wrist if you can.
This?
Yeah, just let the pressure off with this hand.
Now,
yeah, I think you get a couple of Weetabix under that. And there you go. I have to say, now I'm actually very impressed, and there's an apprenticeship looming there if you ever give up your radio career.
Fair enough, no problem.
Law of Yainta is an IWR Media production for Highland Radio, written and presented by Mary Brophy and produced by Neil Boyle. funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.